Welcome back.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, Chuck Palahniuk from the Writers on a New England Stage series. His novels are often about or narrated by people cast out by society. They're mostly male, usually self-destructive and violent, and often addicted or slouching toward recovery. His transgressive fiction has touched a nerve among readers, inspiring a rabid following that calls itself the cult. The new book, Damned, is set in hell, where Madison, the plucky, pudgy 13-year-old daughter of narcissistic Hollywood celebrities, lands after overdosing on marijuana. The fiery furnace of Damned is a sluggish bureaucracy, swirling in bodily fluids and menaced by ravenous demons. The Damned make internet pornography or work as operators at a call center programmed to disturb people around the world just as they sit down to dinner. I sat down with Chuck to ask him about Damned and included questions submitted by the audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. I asked him how he came up with his vision of hell.
When you tour on book tours, big hotels typically have what they call an author's suite. It's a couple rooms, usually with a fireplace and a big bookcase, and they put all the visiting authors in that suite. And part of the ritual is you sign and date a book that goes in that big bookcase. And normally when you check into a hotel room, you like to think that that mattress is a virgin, has never been with anyone else. But in the author's suite, you know that mattress has been with Paula Deen. It's been with her like 6 times, and the books are dated. So you know that that mattress has been with David Sedaris and Paula Deen and Jane Fonda and Lee Childs, and it goes on and on. And there's this part of me that always starts to scour the room for fingernail clippings and Ann Coulter hairs. And when I pull back the sheets in that mattress pad, it's always, you have to wonder, is Nora Roberts the bedwetter? It's like the Shroud of Turin multiplied. And it really is that disconnect between all their noble thoughts, all their highest endeavors that are lining the wall, and all of their corporeal left-behind scabs that are in the carpet, that disconnect between the body and the mind that I find so fascinating. And so hell is all these left-behind little fingernail clippings and scabs and blackheads. I'm not trying to be funny here.
So you get an idea, perhaps, of this vision of hell in Damned, if you haven't read the book yet. Mounds of dandruff that people have to wade through. Rivers of vomit and seas of excrement. And scabs, of course. When you write this stuff, do you sort of think, this is really going to gross people out, or is this just all inside your head?
Oh, come on. These are people that watch Anthony Bourdain eating whatever. In a way, I always thought that that Dante's Inferno was just travel writing. No, it is. It's, you know, Anthony Bourdain goes to hell and eats the insides out of a snake. I mean, that's hell. That's why we watch it. Charles Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle, travel writing. Gulliver's Travels, travel writing. And so in a way, with Damned, I just wanted to take my shot at travel writing.
Wow. But we do see Dante's vision of hell, and Jonathan Swift especially, crawling over these giant bodies in this book. But also Judy Blume.
The book has a kind of preamble structure, like Judy Blume's Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. That Judy Blume story really typifies a real classic form of story. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is about a young woman who is compelled to move into the suburbs and completely adapt to a new environment without understanding why. Very much like Shawshank Redemption, is a man thrust into prison, not really understanding why, just having to make the best of it. And that's very much what Damned is, a young woman waking up in hell. And so I wanted to use a really classically established form, you know, and in this case, Judy Blume's form.
And she is a 13-year-old girl. She's overweight. She's both sort of repelled and fascinated by sex. I'm just wondering how you, somebody who is associated with very muscular male writing in a way, adopted this voice of a 13-year-old, and how you maintained it.
You know, once you kind of create the wardrobe of phrases that a character has, you have a great credibility and you have a great speed in reusing that wardrobe, because most of us have a set group of phrases that we use. What I love is studying what people say when the conversation falls to zero. Where I grew up, people would always say, "Must be 7 minutes after the hour," because I was raised Catholic, and it was believed that Christ died at 7 minutes after the hour. So all conversations would fall to silence at 7 minutes after the hour. And Jewish people say, you know, when that conversation fails, they say, another Jewish baby's been born. But these transitional sort of ritual phrases that we have for bridging moments, you establish all of these kind of utilitarian phrases for a character. And it creates a character with a continuity and a credibility that you don't get if you're constantly reinventing the character's speech. So it was very easy to come up with the kind of phrases that she uses consistently.
And Hal's kind of almost a relief for her. She's very relieved she doesn't have to take the SATs, for example. But it's not all that different. In fact, it may be even better for her because she makes friends. She makes this kind of breakfast club of friends.
Right. And I always thought that the breakfast club was a really clever way of retelling Sartre's No Exit. Because it's...
they're in eternal detention.
Exactly, with people you wouldn't normally socially interact with, and you're driving each other crazy, and you have no other choice. So it's existentialism with better music.
We have the jock, we have the cheerleader type, Babette, we have the kind of rebel, and also the nerd, Leonard, who's a great sort of vehicle for teaching her about the history of hell. Give us a little bit of the history of hell in the book Damned.
Hell. I love the fact that, to my understanding, one of the common ideas of where Satan came from, Lucifer, was that Lucifer really was this wonderful, beautiful child of God, and that heaven was this wonderful, happy place until God kind of cheated. God kind of went off and started a new franchise somewhere else, and suddenly his old family was expected to accept and adopt this new family. And like for so many of us who found ourselves as children, you know, being introduced to our new brothers and sisters under the Christmas tree and expected to interact these very intimate family rituals with total strangers, you know, being expected to accept this whole new set of siblings at a moment's notice. I could see why Satan would be pissed off. And so hell, it consists of all those people that God kind of left behind and resented being left behind. And it consists of a lot of gods of previous cultures that were discarded and kind of cast into exile.
Along with Liberace, well, Robert Mapplethorpe.
Dante did it, I can do it.
And the catalog of sins that they land there for are pretty interesting. You know, wearing white after Labor Day.
Brown shoes with a blue purse?
Yeah, brown. Yeah. It's not any more ridiculous than going to hell for killing an ass, I suppose.
Or wearing mixed fiber clothing.
Well, you just mentioned something about her ultra-liberal parents who think that they have an insurance policy against anything bad happening to them if they support biodiesel and wind power and that kind of thing. But Maddie truly, truly, truly misses them.
She does, and that was the basis for writing the book. This is how the hideous comedy tragedy of everything is. In 2008, I was promoting the release of the movie Choke, which is a comedy based on this son trying to save his mother who's dying in the hospital. And at the same time, my mother was diagnosed with large cell lung cancer, stage 4. And so I spent the whole year going from gala, white tie movie premiere to chemotherapy lounge, hospital deathbed, to gala premiere, to chemo lounge, to gala premiere, to eventually funeral. And in the last few months of my mother's life, I was writing this book because I knew that my father, who was killed in 99, he was gone, and that very soon that she was going to be gone. And I knew that the grief was going to be overwhelming, but that it wasn't going to be any fun to write a book about a 49-year-old man who missed both of his dead parents. But if I could invert the situation and make it about a dead child, a spunky dead child, a spunky fat dead child, who missed and mourned her parents, but they were still alive on earth, then I could make it a funny book and I could have fun writing it, and I could still express my grief, and hopefully people would have a lot more fun reading it. And at the same time, the morning she died, and my sister and I were there with her dead body, we'd left the Catholic Church 30 years ago. We had no idea, what do you do? We had no narrative left for what do you do with a dead body. And we were really cast adrift. And that's something that we've lost by, you know, walking away from religion. We've lost the ritual of what do you do at this moment. So in a way, writing this book was a way to mourn, but also a way to kind of point out the fact that we lose a lot when we lose religion.
What did you do?
We called the paramedics. I thought, oh, I should take her Percodan and Vicodin while it's still there. And you know what they do first? Even before they take her out, they take the narcotics. It's state law. I don't know what I cried over more. See, it's better when it's funny.
Well, the first impression that we get of Maddie's mother is she's grieving, and she's a very wealthy woman with houses all over the world, and she is locking Maddie's former rooms via her computer, you know, just hitting Control L on the room in Milan, in Venice, or wherever. This kind of detached grief, but also she's a ghostly presence, you know? Maddie's very much alive. She's very much with us. And I wonder if your mother was a ghostly presence in this story in any way for you.
She was just in, you know, both my parents were just in, you know, the shock of losing them both. You know, my father died at 59. My mother died at 69.
And your father died tragically. He was murdered.
He was murdered in 99. Oh, the summer that the Fight Club movie came out, he was shot and killed by a kind of a deranged man. And Fight Club culminates with the lead character being shot and killed. And then the movie Choke came out about the mother dying fairly young. And my mother died very similarly. And my sister came to me and said, you've put a curse on our family. Don't you dare have a movie go into production where a sister dies. That's what I'm writing right now. And any one of you, I'll find you and write a movie about you.
Did you have anyone in mind, you know, couple-wise, flying around the world, adopting children?
Not going to burn that bridge. Nope.
Okay, leads to my next question. From Michelle, did you meet Brad Pitt?
That's the best question you could pull out of that stack.
When we return, I'll look for audience questions that Chuck Palahniuk finds more impressive, find out why 12-step programs frequently show up in his books, and hear about how he processes life through story. That's when Word of Mouth returns with Chuck Palahniuk. After a short break, this is NHPR.